The headlines: Iran's president roundly rejects direct talks with the U.S. on the 2015 deal, saying Tehran sees no benefit in such negotiations. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro says his country has received another Iranian-built oil tanker. And tensions escalate on the border between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan as their border guards exchange fire, leaving several people killed or injured. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumish Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran's president has rejected direct talks with the United States to revive the 2015 deal, saying that such negotiations have left no benefit. In an interview with Al Jazeera, Ibrahim Raisi said the interests of the Iranian nation are not based on direct negotiations. He said it is now up to the U.S. to make a final decision on the revival of the deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Raisi also commented on new U.S. sanctions on the country. He said why the American side takes such measures if it wants an agreement. He emphasized that the sanctions removal must be accompanied by a guarantee in order to achieve a lasting agreement. Elsewhere, Raisi stressed that the progress in the JCPOA revival talks also requires the resolution of the safeguards issues with the UN nuclear agency. Iran has repeatedly said that the deal is possible if the U.S. acts realistically. Iran's president says cooperation among countries targeted by U.S. sanctions will make them stronger.
The relationship between countries that are sanctioned by the U.S., such as Iran, Russia, or other countries, can overcome many problems and issues and make them stronger.
The Iranian president said Americans think that by imposing sanctions against the country, they can stop it, but they are wrong. Referring to the JCPOA revival talks, Raisi censured the Western states for proposing to hold negotiations while at the same time imposing new sanctions. He said they need to demonstrate goodwill for the revival of the 2015 deal. Raisi is in Uzbekistan to attend the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit. He made the remarks in a meeting with his Russian counterpart. Raisi said Iran and Russia can offset the effects of U.S. sanctions by joining their forces. The two presidents underscored a joint resolve to enhance strategic ties. Vladimir Putin said relations with Iran are positively developing.
Relations between Russia and Iran are developing on all the vectors that have been formed in previous years. We are in the final stage of working on a new major treaty between Russia and Iran, which will mark the developing of relations at the level of a strategic partnership.
Putin said a delegation from Russia with representatives of 80 large companies will visit Iran next week. The Russian president welcomed Iran becoming a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. On Wednesday, Iran signed an SCO, Memorandum of Obligations and Agreements, getting one step closer to becoming the ninth member of the regional body. Iran's accession is expected to be finalized by April 2023. We have reached out to Eurasia and Caucasus Affairs expert Ahmad Qasimzadeh to discuss the importance of Iran's membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. He believes that the SCO can be considered the NATO of the East.
Regarding the significance of Iran's membership in the SCO, it should be noted that the organization includes several countries such as China, India, with a high population, almost half world population, with major economic benefits for member states. I can also refer to security matters. The SCO summit can be considered as the NATO of the East, and that includes the economic, political, and security spheres. It can bring about the interests and benefits for member states.
Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro says his country has received a new oil tanker from Iran.
We have just taken delivery of a ship with the most advanced engineering and technology in the world, built by the Iranians, commissioned by us, and that is now coming to serve as a cargo ship for our revolutionary PDVSA.
Based on a contract between Tehran and Caracas, Iran will deliver a total of 4 tankers to Venezuela. The two countries are both targeted by U.S. sanctions. In recent years, they have expanded their cooperation, especially in the energy sector. In June this year, the presidents of Iran and Venezuela signed a 20-year document to further expand bilateral relations. The document focuses on petrochemical, oil, economic, tourism, cultural, and political cooperation. It was signed during Maduro's visit to Tehran. And now reports of new border clashes between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. Kyrgyzstan's border guard service says several of its outposts have once again come under attack by Tajik forces. The service says its border guards have hit back by opening fire on Tajik positions along the frontier. Tajikistan says Kyrgyz forces have used heavy weaponry, shelling one of its outposts in 7 villages. It says a civilian was killed and 3 others were wounded as a result. The latest flare-up follows a brief confrontation between the two Central Asian countries earlier this week. The governor of the provinces adjacent to the border are set to meet later in the day to try to defuse the situation. Border clashes are frequent between the two former Soviet states. Russia has urged them to cease hostilities. And Pakistan is grappling with a surge in cases of waterborne diseases such as dengue fever following the recent floods there.
We do not have the exact data, but according to the data that we have, more than 4,000 people are suffering from this. According to the data we're receiving, this tally is increasing by about 150 to 200 patients daily. It is widespread, but we're trying to contain its vector, the mosquito.
The minister has said that other conditions, including diarrhea, malaria, and skin diseases, are also widespread. The health crisis is adding to problems of the Pakistani authorities. They have been under pressure to deliver aid to millions of people displaced by the floods. The natural disaster was caused by monsoon rains and melting glaciers, affecting almost 33 million people. Nearly 1,500 have lost their lives. Pakistan has repeatedly called for international help to deal with the aftermath of the floods. The UN Special Rapporteur Alina Duhan has presented her report to the World Body Human Rights Council. The scathing report recounts effects of unilateral sanctions. It points out how such measures by the U.S. severely impact economies and the lives of people, especially in the case of Iran. Still, the question is whether the U.S. will be held to account over the sanctions or the report can result in preventing these measures.
Alina Duhan is the UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. Back in May, she paid an 11-day visit to Iran to assess the impact of sanctions on the country. During her trip, she met with Iran's human rights officials and members of non-governmental organizations. She has now released her final report on the visit and made her presentation of her findings at the UNHCR. In her report, Duhan criticized the unilateral sanctions imposed on Iran. She has also called for the removal of unilateral coercive measures and asked the U.S. to come up with mechanisms of compensation for the victims of such measures. She also noted that decades of sanctions have affected Iranian people's lives and have particularly hit the low-income section of the society. Duhan also noted that the use of unilateral sanctions, secondary sanctions, and overcompliance has had an adverse effect on the broad spectrum of human rights, civil, political, economic, social, and cultural development.
Iran has suffered from the extension of U.S. jurisdiction in the international banking transactions due to the involvement of U.S. correspondent banks or payments in U.S. dollars, which has not only caused serious disruptions and delays in the provision of basic goods, but also has seriously impeded Iran's engagement in international cooperation.
The use or threat of secondary sanctions or civil and criminal penalties constitutes de facto a new form of reprisals towards individuals, states and companies, considered to be associated with targeted entities or to circumvent unilateral sanctions regimes, despite the recognized illegality of this application of extraterritorial jurisdiction of states. Secondary sanctions and overcompliance make states, businesses, humanitarian organizations, and individuals look for alternative means to procure necessary goods, which results in growing costs, delays in delivery, growing risks of corruption and other types of transboundary crimes, and endanger the status of humanitarian organizations.
We will recall that the United Nations General Assembly in December 2020 Resolution 75181, 131 countries voted unilateral coercive measures and legislation are contrary to international law, international humanitarian law, the Charter of the United Nations, and the norms and principles governing peaceful relations among states. And it's quite simple under the Charter to so the U.S. cannot intervene and apply sanctions against your country because it's contrary to the sovereign equality of nations.
Yet, there have been opposition to her statements and places of visit. Criticism of her visit to Iran and a scathing report on the cruel U.S. sanctions have been led by Hillel Noyer, executive director of UNW. He has argued that Duhan is a lobbyist for repressive regimes. Yet Noyer himself is guilty of that. He has been a staunch supporter of the Israeli regime and supports the oppression and cruel human rights violations against Palestinians. This in turn makes him void of being impartial and a judge on human rights.
During her speech, Elena Duhan, who visited Iran recently, gave first-hand accounts of how the U.S. sanctions have severely impacted the lives of Iranians over decades. She particularly pointed out how secondary sanctions are compounding the problem. Kazem Gharibabadi, Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, was also present at the session. He rejected U.S. claims of exempting food and medicines from sanctions. He called it a whitewash, saying those life-saving items never make it to Iran.
Right after the 1979 victory of the Islamic Revolution, the U.S. imposed economic, trade and financial sanctions with a comprehensive trade ban since 1995. Since the mid-2000s, a series of executive orders created a broad framework of prohibitions and bans against Iran. Those restrictions intensified after 2010 and covered the energy sector and other key economic sectors. The sanctions against Iran's financial sector included designations and asset freezes affecting the Iranian Central Bank and commercial banks. The EU adopted comprehensive economic, trade and some other sanctions against Iran since 2010. Those measures were intensified in the following years with an oil embargo in 2012. Those sanctions were lifted or were temporarily frozen following the 2015 nuclear deal. But back in May 2018, the U.S. began to unilaterally impose sanctions against Iran after former President Donald Trump's administration abandoned the agreement. He also launched what he called a maximum pressure campaign against Iran at the time, targeting the Iranian nation with the toughest ever sanctions. Trump failed in his anti-Iran campaign, but his anti-Iran measures have hurt the Iranian population.
Iranian people are the main innocent victims of the inhumane unilateral coercive measures that have been imposed against them under the failed so-called policy of maximum pressure, which is designed and implemented as a means of war to commit crimes against humanity, persecution and genocide against our people.
In a sense, the UN has failed to answer the crying needs of countries like yours or like Syria, secondary sanctions like in Lebanon, Zimbabwe, Cuba, where the situation is very difficult. However, I think it's going to change now, and it probably won't be resolved by the United Nations, but by regional economic organizations.
Strict bans on banking transactions have made it impossible for Iran to access critically needed medicine and medical equipment over the past years. Iran has described those sanctions as a crime against humanity. One case in point is Iran's patients suffering from epidermolysis bullosa, or EB, which is a special skin disease. They are suffering because a Swedish company which produces special bandages needed for remedial purposes refuses to give Iran the critical material due to US sanctions.
France has announced price caps for home energy prices. Now, many are upset that the caps will not begin until next year, as the government has done nothing to restrict the price of petrol. Millions of lovers of the third Shia Imam have flocked to the Iraqi city of Karbala to mourn the anniversary of the 40th day of his martyrdom. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, is veneered in the Muslim world for upholding justice. He is a universal symbol of freedom as well as resilience against oppression. Now a convoy that reflects the Palestinian cause is also participating in the Arbaeen March. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of our weekly series, Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to mankind, the Holy Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In our last program in this series, we completed the explanation of Surah Hadid, and from this Friday onwards, we embark on explanation of the next surah, that is Surah Al-Mujadila, or the Pleader, which is number 58 in the serial order of compilation of the Holy Quran. It has 22 ayahs and was revealed in Medina. It mentions the complaint of a woman whose husband had put her away for no good reason for resorting to the pagan Arab formula known as zihar, which consists of the words you are to me as the back of my mother. This was a pagan custom to imply a kind of divorce that freed the husband from any responsibility for conjugal duties as well as providing support for children without allowing the wife the freedom to leave the husband's home or to contract a second marriage. The woman, who along with her husband had become a Muslim, pleaded to the Holy Prophet against this unjust behavior and said that she also lacked the means to support her little children. Her prayer to Allah and her plea was accepted, and this brutal and unjust custom of the pagan Arabs was abolished through revelation of this surah in the Holy Quran, which goes on to state that those who oppose God and the Prophet, or fall to the temptations of Satan, or lie in the oaths and make intrigue against the Prophet, will be defeated and suffer humiliation, both in this world and in the hereafter. While Hezbollah, or the Party of God, which means those who have firm faith in God, will triumph. The penalty prescribed for the husband who repents his act is to set a slave free, or fast for 3 months, and if not, to feed 60 destitute persons. Then only he can claim his conjugal rights. Such penalties were instrumental in the abolition of slavery in a rational and evolutionary way without creating chaos and disorder in society, in addition to providing welfare for the needy. As for the merits of reciting this surah, a narration from the Holy Prophet reads, "Whoever recites Surah Hadid and Surah Mujadala and reflects and acts upon them will be regarded as a member of Hezbollah or the Party of God." Let us listen to ayahs 1 and 2 of Surah Mujadala.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qad sami'a Allahu qawla allati tujadiluka fi zawjiha wa tashtaki ila Allahi wallahu yasma'u tahawurakuma. Inna Allaha sami'un basir. الذين يظاهرون منكم من نسائهم ما هن أمهاتهم إن أمهاتهم إلا اللائي ولدنهم وإنهم ليقولون منكرا من القول وزورا وَإِنَّ اللَّهَ لَعَفُونْ غَفُورٌ.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Allah has certainly heard the speech of her who pleads with you about her husband and complains to Allah. Allah hears the conversation between the two of you. Indeed, Allah is all-hearing, all-seeing. As for those of you who repudiate their wives by zihar, they are not their mothers. Their mothers are only those who bore them, and indeed, they utter an outrageous utterance and a lie. And indeed, Allah is all excusing, all forgiving. These ayahs negate the unjust and irrational pagan Arab practice of zihar, which we have already explained, and denounce those who, in spite of becoming Muslim, still cling on to such customs, which are indeed lies and outrageous utterances, and for the forgiveness of which the husbands are required to pay certain penalties. It is worth noting that Ayah 1 refers three times to the power of hearing of the unseen but omnipresent Creator, who listens to whatever we say and is even aware of the thoughts that flash across our minds. Therefore, we should avoid lies and evil utterances and instead supplicate to God to answer our prayers. The next ayah clearly says that those who tell their wives, "You are like my mother to me," utter a falsehood, since the mother is the one who gives birth, which means being a mother or a child depends neither on words nor sophistry, but it is an indisputable biological reality. In other words, if a husband were to say even 100 times to his wife that she is a mother to him, it is nothing but falsehood, for which he should repent and seek forgiveness from the Almighty Creator. From these ayahs we learn that 1. The Holy Prophet of Islam was always accessible to all the people who could, without any restrictions, approach him for their needs or seek clarification of issues which were not clear to them. 2. The oppressive and irrational customs of pre-Islamic Arabia against women were either cancelled or corrected by Islam. 3. The Almighty Creator is well aware of all family issues as well as social relations and has accordingly decreed just and fair laws. 4. Husband and wife should not indulge in evil behavior towards each other, since abusive words have negative impact on family life, including the tender psychology of children. Let us now listen to ayahs 3 and 4 of Surah Mujadala of the Holy Quran.
وَالَّذِينَ يُظَاهِرُونَ مِن نِّسَائِهِمْ ثُمَّ يَعُودُونَ لِمَا قَالُوا فَتَحْرِيرُ رَقَبَةٍ مِّن قَبْلِ أَن يَتَمَاسَّا ذلكم توعظون به والله بما تعملون خبير فمن لم يجد فصيام شهرين متتابعين من قبل أن يتماسا فمن لم يستطع فإطعام 60 مسكينا ذلك لتؤمنوا بالله ورسوله وتلك حدود الله وللكافرين عذاب أليم.
And those who repudiate their wives by zihar and then retract from what they have said shall set free a slave before they may touch each other. This you're advised to carry out, and Allah is well aware of what you do. He who cannot afford to free a slave shall fast for 2 successive months before they, husband and wife, may touch each other. If he cannot do so, he shall feed 60 destitute persons. This is in order that you may have faith in Allah and His Prophet. These are Allah's bounds, and there is a painful punishment for the faithless. Here it is stressed that merely by uttering zihar, a husband cannot divorce his wife, and the one who utters such a phrase should retract his words and pay the penalties stipulated in these ayahs for irresponsible behavior before resuming the conjugal relationship. These penalties are to strengthen one's faith in God and the Prophet, and refusal to observe these divine injunctions is an indication of disbelief for which there is painful punishment in afterlife. In other words, compensation for sins through expiation strengthens the pillars of faith and makes a Muslim practically committed to observance of divine laws. These ayahs teach us the following points. 1. Islam negates irrational customs and superstitions that are indeed a form of oppression in society, and prescribes penalties for those who indulge in such abominable behavior. 2. It is not lawful to utter absurd and abusive words. 3. Islam has used every opportunity to set slaves free, so that this tyrannical habit of holding fellow human beings in bondage is eradicated. And 4. Expiation and fines are stipulated in various forms to remove social injustice and to help the poor and the needy. And to conclude this week's program, here are ayahs 5 and 6 of Surah Mujadala of the Holy Quran.
إِنَّ الَّذِينَ يُحَادُّونَ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ كُبِتُوا كَمَا كُبِتَ الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِهِمْ وَقَدْ أَنزَلْنَا آيَاتٍ بَيِّنَاتٍ وَلِلْكَافِرِينَ عَذَابٌ مُهِينٌ يَوْمَ يَبْعَثُهُمُ اللَّهُ جَمِيعًا فَيُنَبِّئُهُمْ بِمَا عَمِلُوا أَحْصَاهُ اللَّهُ وَنَسُوهُ وَاللَّهُ عَلَى كُلِّ شَيْءٍ شَهِيدٌ
Indeed, those who oppose Allah and His Prophet will be subdued just as were subdued those before them. And we have certainly sent down manifest signs, and there is a humiliating punishment for the faithless. The day when Allah will raise them all together, He will inform them about what they have done. Allah has kept account of it, while they forgot it, and Allah is witness to all things. These ayahs mean to say that refusal to observe divine laws is tantamount to opposing God and the Holy Prophet, and such persons will meet the fate of the disobedient generations of the past. God Almighty has sent down manifest signs for the guidance of mankind, and for the faithless, the punishment is terrible. That is, chastisement in the transient life of the mortal world, and for those who do not repent and reform themselves, the torment in afterlife is more severe. On the day of resurrection, when all people will be raised to life for the final judgment, God will inform the defaulters of what they used to do, even if they have forgotten their words, their deeds and actions, which are all minutely recorded in the divine register. The Almighty Creator is the witness of everything. These ayahs teach us that 1. Any opposition and obstruction to divine commandments will result in misery for man both in this world and in the hereafter. And 2. Those belying the prophets are actually belying God and are thus doomed. And 3. On the day of judgment, the disbelievers and sinners will be given the record of their misdeeds to see themselves before being punished.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The passing away of Queen Elizabeth II may be a sad day for a lot of people, especially in the UK. But at the same time, there are many who do not think about the Queen in positive terms. Some examples: the massacre in Northern Ireland, chemical attack by British forces in Iraq, the role it played in a coup against Iran's Mossadegh government. Well, those are just some of the things that happened during her watch over the UK. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will review some of the atrocities committed by the UK while the Queen resided at her palace and ask, was her role really ceremonial? And isn't it time to abolish the monarchy? A question that many are asking at this point. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Assistant Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Tehran, Arya Barzan Mohammadi, joins us. And we have Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute at the London Metropolitan University, George Zamyeli, who joins us from Budapest.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. George, let me first start with you. We are taking a look at the headlines on mainstream media that are mourning the Queen pretty much nonstop from the time this occurred. And, of course, now Charles' accession to power. But then there are those that are calling for abolish the monarchy, which is a hashtag that's now trending loudly on social media. What are your thoughts on that aspect of the news about the Queen's death and, of course, Charles ascending to the throne?
Well, I don't think, to be honest, that there will be much change in British foreign policy were the monarchy abolished. I don't think the Queen ever really had much of a say in governmental policy. In fact, the Queen, even in realms where she might have had a say, an influence, for instance, in the Church of England. I mean, she's the head of the Church of England. She really, you know, took a hands-off approach. She was very much a ceremonial monarch, very popular for being so. But in terms of the foreign policy and all of the objectionable aspects of British foreign policy during her lengthy reign, and you mentioned a few of them, she really didn't make those decisions. And therefore, you know, whether under King Charles or a republic, and, you know, all governmental decisions made by Prime Minister Liz Truss, I don't think there would be a huge difference in policy.
Well, there are some calls, however, that are being made to that effect, but more so, and maybe worth mentioning in a sense, If you can tell us what you recall, Mr. Mohammed, about some of the atrocities or conflicts, perhaps, that happened during her watch. There's a list of them, some of them that perhaps stand out as you had the Iraq and Syria, where Operation Shader took place from the year 2014. You have the Persian Gulf War, the Sierra Leone Civil War. I'm looking down a list here, the Suez Crisis. Of course, the Iraq War, Yemen and Afghanistan wars worth also mentioning. Is it correct to see these as being what she oversaw and could have done something about, or completely detached from these occurrences during the time that she obviously was alive?
Well, I agree with your other guest that Queen's authority is very much ceremonial on the paper. However, we mustn't forget that she used to meet with Prime Minister on a weekly basis and provide advices. That's one thing, how she could have had some influence on decision-making. And also, what we didn't see, or what she should have done, is to express her disagreement with some of the atrocities that you have mentioned, you know, loudly and publicly. I mean, I couldn't understand. I mean, what, for example, what happened in Kenya just maybe days after she took the throne, she became the queen, and the atrocities against the Mau Mau movement in that country. As I mean, according to the New York Times, the response by the colonial authorities over there led to the establishment of vast system of detention camps and torture, abuse and killing of tens of thousands of people. And even the British government eventually agreed to pay £20 million in lawsuit compensation to the survivors of that atrocities. So in response or in answering your question, yes, the Queen enjoyed only ceremonial powers, but as a human being, she should have done more to at least detach herself from some of the atrocities that her governments have committed, from the coup against the Mossadegh to what happened in Kenya, to the apartheid regime in South Africa, the exercises, the acts against human rights over there. And you can mention many others. And not only that, we shouldn't forget the legacy, the historical legacy of the British Empire. So we shouldn't just look at her reign from 1952, but we should go further or back to the history, look back to the history and see what kind of atrocities and the crimes that the British Empire committed from the times of King George II,
sure,
to the times of Elizabeth II.
Well, Joyce Amoyeli, we're looking at what our guest said here about Mau Mau, and this happened right after her father's death. So you have her then take over the throne, and you have what our guest there referred to as a source in terms of how he explained it, and that was the New York Times, leading to the establishment of a vast system of detention camps, as our guest there quoted the New York Times, torture, rape, castration, and the killing of tens of thousands of people. Since that was right after her father's death and when she took over the throne, could she not have then played a role in preventing from that happening then?
I doubt it. I think that had she interfered in any aspect of British policy, whether in foreign affairs or in domestic affairs, it would have led to the swift demise of the monarchy. At least, you know, she would definitely have believed that was the case. I mean, the British worked out a formula for what they called a constitutional monarchy, even though Great Britain actually doesn't have a written constitution. It's a constitutional monarchy, which means that the monarch is essentially a non-political person, doesn't in any way interfere in any aspect of governmental policy. I mean, the governments are formed, they go to the queen, establishes the government, and then, you know, when governments are closed down shop, you know, they go and tell the queen that that's it, the government is dissolved. That's her role. If she were to start saying, well, I don't like this policy and I don't like that policy, it would have brought about a constitutional crisis and would have led to the demise of the monarchy. And I think she saw her role as someone who wants the monarchy to continue. She wants to be the person who inherited the crown from her father and who will then pass the crown on to her son. Uh-huh. And doubtless Charles thinks that he's going to pass the crown on to his son. I mean, that's the way the system works. You can't really expect them to operate according to rules that you may like, but they obviously don't identify with.
Sure. Well, here's the problem that many see. And maybe you could shed more light on this or explain this to us, Mr. Muhammad. And that is the fact that, according to the way our guest describes it, if this was a one-off or maybe something that occurred twice during her 70 years when she had the throne, it could be dismissed as such, perhaps. And many may maybe look at it in a different way, but there are many who are holding the monarchy, and in particular her, responsible, since this has occurred so many times. For example, one of the social media reactions, if the Queen had apologized for slavery, colonialism, and neo-colonialism, and urged the Crown to offer reparations for the millions of lives taken in their names, then perhaps I would do the human being thing, or the human thing, and feel bad. As a Kenyan, I feel nothing. This theater is absurd. There are many people who hold her responsible. Do you think then, therefore, that she, again, could have exerted some type of influence when you're having repeated acts that spell that are of this nature?
Of course. I mean, she was a human being, after all. I mean, let me disagree with your guest, with the professor, because just years ago when, the voting for Brexit took place, everyone knew that Queen was against Brexit. So probably if she could have voted, she would have voted again for no Brexit or not exiting the European Union. So people in England knew about Queen's opinion regarding Brexit. And she must have expressed it in the closed circles, and then this has found its way to the newspapers and tabloids, etc., etc. So I don't see what was the problem with making her opinion known to the people regarding some of these atrocities that you are mentioning. And I understand the role of monarchy in a constitutional monarchy in Europe, but we shouldn't forget that these things are not issues of budget or appointing this minister or removing that minister or canceling this or that program. These are really, really severe decisions with the severe consequences that one should have reacted to them and as a human being and had a moral responsibility to actually oppose them if she thought that these were against her moral stance or ethics or agreed with them. So that's one thing. The other thing is that the monarchy, if we look at it even as a ceremonial or in something that is written not in a written constitution or in a constitutional monarchy, if we look at other countries such as Scandinavian monarchies, we see some sort of a socialist monarchy. We don't see the same luxurious expending and the lifestyle that we see in British monarchy. And also they have less of controversies from now and then. We know that the controversy surrounding the issues regarding Prince Andrew and other things. British people, many of them, would demand more clarity and more responsiveness regarding taxpayers' money being spent on luxurious weddings or ceremonies or lifestyles, while at the moment people are struggling with their fuel providing fuel for their cars and paying for their electricity bills. This is not to say that, you know, we are going to say to the British people what system they should choose for themselves. This is up to the British people. But we shouldn't forget that the British monarchy's legacy is not exclusive to Britain. It goes beyond that. And currently, King Charles III, he has a lot of challenges to deal with. Namely, first of all, a second referendum, Scottish independence referendum is on the paper. So we might see a potential breakup of the United Kingdom, mm-hmm. the unraveling of the Commonwealth, and reckoning with the unsavory past, parts of the royal family's past and its colonial legacy. So we have to see what kind of King Charles III would be. Is he going to remain silent on most of these issues or quiet, or he will decide to speak up and try to apologize to people of India, people in Africa, and other Commonwealth and other former colonies?
George Samioli, one of the questions that has been asked, and perhaps you can clarify for us or explain to us what the real reason is, and that is why the Queen never visited Israel. I mean, you read one source that says because the Queen did not like what Israel did in the occupied territories in terms of, the violation of Palestinians as a whole. Others say it's because of trade deals with the Persian Gulf Arab countries, didn't want to upset them. But many sources are pointing towards the violations of Palestinians, which then doesn't fall in line with the rest of the violations that took place on different countries that were part of the colonialism that the UK exercised.
That's a very good question, and it's it may be all of those things. She also probably has it's a sore point with her about the terrorism that took place during the time of the British occupation of Palestine, during the time of the Mandate, when Israeli terrorists, well, they weren't Israeli then, but the Stern Gang, actually were murdering British officials. And that may well be a sore point with her. I don't know. It definitely is odd, but it wouldn't surprise me if there was some issue that that she feels strongly about what happened during the years of the British Mandate in Palestine.
Okay. Well, you talked about Prince Charles there, Arya Barzal Mohammed. There's a social media again reaction to him taking over the throne, and that is, why should there even be a throne for him to take over? What is going to be the purpose? I mean, does that serve the 21st century type of governance that should exist? You know, those questions are resurfacing, especially right now. So isn't that a valid point of view for many to have, especially at this point in time where the UK, like many other European countries, but the UK is suffering economically so badly that many would question, why should taxpayers' money go towards whatever it is that he's going to be doing?
It's not a secret to anyone that King Charles III doesn't enjoy the same popularity that his mother enjoyed inside the UK, at least. I mean, her mother, opinion the world has about her, was very popular inside the UK, or at least in England, if we exclude Scotland and Ireland. But Prince Charles doesn't enjoy even the same popularity inside England. And the reason, part of that is because of the story of Diana and the divorce, and the family matters, private matters. And other part is that he is very, his style is very politically active style. So he likes to talk, when he was Prince of Wales, the Crown Prince, he usually commented about politics, about, what type of ministers should a certain prime minister choose, or what type of policies is preferable. So he was very talkative about it. And one of the famous sentences or that he mentioned was after the return of Hong Kong to China, when he joked with it and called it a Chinese takeaway, which made Chinese government very angry with that comment. So his activism might create some sort of controversy for him. It either could make him more popular if his activism is on the side of the people, if he decide to cut some of the budgets that for luxury spending and lifestyle, and try to treat members of his family, especially his brother, like any other person from the public, or his activism might become a source of a problem for him, especially with regard to issues such as Scottish referendum. Countries like Australia might choose to break away from not the Commonwealth, but to choose another system for themselves instead of monarchy and choose the common republic. So there are a lot of issues that might resurface during King Charles' reign, while there was an agreement that there should keep kept quiet during her mother's reign, because of the prestige, international prestige that she enjoyed, and King Charles III so far doesn't enjoy it.
Thank you for that. Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, London Metropolitan University, George Samueli from Budapest. And thank you, Arya Barzan Mohammadi, Assistant Professor of Middle East Studies, University of Tehran. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitakway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have the honor of hosting two special guests. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, gentlemen. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for having us.
Brother Yasser, how do you do?
I'm good, thank you.
And Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Sayyid, have you ever experienced racism?
I have, many times.
How'd you handle it?
There's nothing to handle. You just let it go. It's not a pressure. It's not a thing that you have to go through. Some people say stupid things to you. You just say salam and salam, and you just walk off. That's it.
There's
a beautiful philosophy I lived by, and obviously it's not mine. By one of the philosophers, and he has like a 20 character name I can't pronounce. He said there are two spheres that you live in.
Uh-huh.
There's an outer sphere and the inner sphere. He said if you put a